Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeological artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we took a tour of the world at the turn of the 16th century. We watched as Portugal became increasingly intolerant of Jews, first enslaving and then expelling them altogether. As the remaining conversos became increasingly nervous, King Manuel I banned converso emigration, trapping them in Portugal. We then traveled east to meet the Jews of Venice, saw the creation of the first Jewish ghetto, and met David Hareuveni and his disciple Shlomo Malcho, whose remarkable journeys led them to travel all of Western Europe and brush shoulders with popes and kings. This week, we will take a look at what was going on in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Americas, while the events of last episode were taking place. I mentioned at the top of last episode that there were three main routes of escape for Spanish Jews fleeing the Inquisition. They could go west to Portugal, north or south to Navarre or Morocco, or east to the Ottoman Empire. But I wasn't quite telling you everything. There was actually a fourth option as well, but it was dangerous, illegal, and not for the faint of heart. This fourth option capitalized on the fact that Europe was in the midst of an exploration craze during the 15th and 16th centuries. Although the European drive to explore dated back to at least the 13th century, when the famous Italian explorer Marco Polo journeyed east to China, it was the Portuguese royalty who really instigated the age of exploration in the mid to late 15th century. Portugal's early forays into exploring other continents were initiated by Henry the Navigator, Prince of Portugal in the early 15th century. Henry was curious by nature, was very interested in the technology of sailing and navigation, and was also devoutly Christian, with a strong motive to rid North Africa from its Muslim rulers. He also wanted to discover new sea trading routes from Africa and India to Portugal, thus diverting wealth away from the Muslims. These Portuguese voyages were immensely successful. By the late 15th century, Portugal had conquered the west coasts of Africa and India, as well as several islands in the Atlantic Ocean, giving them almost complete dominance over several important nautical trade routes. Their presence in Africa gave them access to the African slave trade, something that was already well used by the Muslims, and allowed them to capitalize on sugar production on their newly colonized Atlantic islands. But the Europeans had a fundamentally incomplete understanding of world geography. They were completely unaware of the existence of the American continent, or the continent of Oceania. Instead, they believed that a massive ocean was all that separated the west coast of Europe from the east coast of Asia. Because of the sheer size of this imagined ocean, it was widely believed at the time that it would be impossible to reach the east coast of Asia by sailing west, that sailors would run out of supplies long before they reached land. As a result, no European had attempted to sail west, instead sticking to the coasts of Africa and the west coast of Asia. But there was one man who thought differently, a man named Christopher Columbus. Columbus was born in Genoa, Italy, in around 1451, just a few years after the African slave trade had made its way to Europe. He was fascinated by the writings of Marco Polo, and as he grew up, he bore witness to the ever-expanding successes of the Portuguese explorers. By the time he was 20 years old, Portuguese sailors had made their way as far as Ghana, and by his 36th birthday, they had nearly circumnavigated the entire African continent and had touched down on the west coast of India. By this point, Columbus had become a seasoned navigator and sailor, and had set his sights on the white whale of contemporary European travel. He wanted to be the first to sail west around the world. Columbus's belief in the feasibility of this voyage relied on a fundamental underestimation of the size of the Earth, which was based on the works of a contemporary but somewhat fringe geographer named Toscanelli, an over-reliance on the writings of Marco Polo, and a misinterpretation of the writings of an Arab Muslim astronomer. But Columbus was convinced that the journey was possible, and so in 1481 he began to travel Europe, pitching his plan to the various monarchs, and asking them to supply him with ships, sailors, and money to fund the journey. He pitched to King João II of Portugal, King Henry VII of England, and King Charles VIII of France, all of whom felt that the journey was far too risky to fund. Finally, in 1486, he approached Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, who, after years of convincing, finally gave Columbus the green light to sail west with 3 ships and a crew of 87 Spanish sailors. And so, in August of 1492, Columbus set sail on his ambitious journey west. Now, let's pause just a minute and think about that date, August 1492. It should sound familiar, because it was exactly 1 month after the expulsion of Jews from Spain, and at the absolute peak of the Spanish Inquisition. And so, for the Spanish Jews desperately trying to figure out where to go, Columbus's voyage presented an opportunity, a potential fifth route to escape the Inquisition. As it turns out, Jews and conversos did manage to get involved in Columbus's voyage in several ways. First were some of the private sponsors of the voyage, including Gomez Rascón, a converso who donated the Pinto, one of the 3 ships Columbus took on the voyage. And then there were those conversos who were brave enough to sail with Columbus themselves. Perhaps the most famous of these was Luis Torres, the Arabic to Spanish language translator who Columbus hired to join him on the voyage. Because of the ferocity of the Spanish Inquisition, Columbus had Torres baptized just prior to departure, so as not to provoke the notoriously anti-Semitic Ferdinand and Isabella. When they finally landed in Cuba, Torres was one of the first Europeans to set foot on the American continent, sent inland by Columbus to search for gold. Torres reportedly established good relationships with the indigenous people, and was the first European to learn of the Cuban native tradition of rolling up tobacco leaves and smoking them. This would ultimately lead to the European tobacco craze. Columbus had another converso aboard his ship as well, Juan de Peñalosa, whose role was to ensure that Columbus's crew was united under their captain's leadership. Columbus and his crew finally touched land in October 1492 on the island of San Salvador. He spent the next several months doing some island hopping, exploring the coast of Cuba, and finally reaching the island of Hispaniola, now home to Haiti and the Dominican Republic. He returned to Spain in March of 1493, after a harrowing journey home, with gold, parrots, spices, and slaves in hand, and Ferdinand and Isabella were thrilled. The Spanish monarch sent Columbus back out on a second voyage immediately, and he would ultimately make 3 more trips to the New World between 1492 and 1503. Columbus died in 1506, having introduced Europe to numerous exotic goods, and leaving the first Spanish colonial settlements in Hispaniola and Venezuela. Columbus's discovery of the New World sent shockwaves throughout Europe. And before long, every kingdom had suddenly sent ships west to colonize their own territory. Now, let me just pause here to lend some modern context before we talk any more about the conquest of the Americas. I hope that most of my listeners understand the immense and devastating impact that European colonization had on the cultures of the Americas. In South and Central America, entire empires were decimated and cultures destroyed, including the Incas, the Mayas, and the Aztecs. In North America, the First Nations people were either massacred or subjugated, and the Métis culture was born as European men took indigenous wives. And so, as I explain the impact of early colonization on Jews and conversos, let's not forget about the First Nations who were most significantly impacted by it. One reason that travel to the New World was so dangerous for Jews and conversos was that in the early 16th century, this sort of long-distance travel was forbidden for those with Jewish blood. But in the first 20 years of the 16th century, this law was loosely enforced, and some conversos fleeing the Inquisition did manage to sail to the Americas to start new lives. One of the earliest known converso families to settle in New Spain was the Gomez family, who arrived on Hispaniola in 1507. The father, Juan, was a merchant, originally hailed from the Jewish quarter of Seville. The mother, Beatrice, had been persecuted by the Inquisition in Spain and convicted as a Judaizer. The family, along with their 9-year-old son Gonzalo, stayed on the island for 7 years, after which point Gonzalo, at the age of just 16, joined an expedition further west to Cuba and mainland Central America. Gonzalo ended up becoming a slave owner, farmer and business owner in Ixtapa, Mexico, prospering off the labor of his slaves. Although exploration of the Americas had become all the rage across Europe following Columbus's discovery, Spain continued to lead the charge, and in 1511, an early Spanish conquistador named Diego Velázquez de Cuellar founded the settlement of Baracoa on the northeastern coast of Cuba and became its first governor. 6 years later, in 1517, Velázquez decided to send a group of conquistadors west to explore mainland Mexico. One of the men he sent was one of his trusted friends, a young and ambitious man named Hernán Cortés, who had accompanied Velázquez to Cuba years earlier. But Velázquez had significantly underestimated Cortés's fierce ambition. He ultimately launched a coup against Velázquez, establishing his own city of Veracruz on Mexico's east coast and blazing across the Mexican Strip, conquering its capital city of Tenochtitlan from the Aztecs in August of 1521. It was this swift takeover of Mexico that allowed Spain to rapidly conquer much of Central America, and by 1525, it had captured territory as far south as Guatemala and Honduras, and finally managed to conquer the Yucatan Peninsula from the Maya civilization in 1545. But Cortés didn't venture to Mexico alone. He had a close army of conquistadors with him, among which were several conversos. There was Pedro de Malouenda, a converso from the Spanish city of Burgos who died shortly after the siege of Tenochtitlan, and Alonso Caballero, who served as an admiral in Cortés's army. And then there was Hernando Alonso, a man whose story we know a bit more about. Alonso hailed from the city of Palos in southwestern Spain, and arrived in Cuba in 1517 with an early wave of Spanish colonists. His background was as a pastoralist raising cattle and pigs, and by 1519 he had secured a contract to be the sole provider of meat to Cuba. He was then contracted to supply meat for Cortés's expedition to Mexico, and in the wake of the coup, was sent by Velázquez to try to suppress the rebellion and arrest Cortés for treason. The expedition to arrest Cortés ultimately failed, and Alonso ended up abandoning Velázquez in favor of Cortés, becoming the provider of meat to Mexico City in 1526. But Alonso, along with the other conversos in the New World, would not enjoy this freedom for long. In May of 1527, a Spanish law was passed that no son, grandson, or great-grandson of a converso convicted by the Inquisition could reside in New Spain. If found, they would be immediately deported and have all their property confiscated. That same year, the first Christian clergy and inquisitors arrived in New Spain. A Dominican vicar named Domingo Betanzos was one of the first to arrive, and he persecuted the Inquisition fiercely. Shortly after his arrival, he indicted 17 men for blasphemy, including a converso named Diego Núñez, who had fought against the Aztecs in the siege of Tenochtitlan in 1521. Núñez was accused of throwing stones at a crucifix, and after a trial, he ultimately got away with just a hefty fine. But the following year, Núñez was again accused by the Inquisition, this time of preventing his wife from attending Mass for 40 days following her pregnancy. This time, he was burned at the stake as a secret Jew. It was not uncommon for these accusations to follow conversos for decades in the New World. They were never completely free of the Inquisition, even when acquitted. One example is the case of Diego Morales, an early converso immigrant to the New World, who in the early 1520s was accused of making blasphemous statements, including denying the legitimacy of Jesus and the Virgin Mary. In 1525, he was convicted and all of his property was confiscated. Morales, ashamed and afraid, moved to Oaxaca, but in 1538 was arrested and fined once again on charges of blasphemy. 20 years later, in 1558, he was accused for the third time, this time by business rivals who claimed that he had cursed the king, conducted business on Christian holidays, refused to eat pork, and mocked the Eucharist. He was convicted once again, miraculously getting off with just a hefty fine. Even Gonzalo Gomez, son of the earliest converso family in the New World, was not safe from the Inquisition. In 1536, dozens of accusations were hurled against him by 13 of his business rivals, including accusations of desecrating God, mocking the forced baptism of indigenous children, changing his bed linens and clothes on Fridays, and refusing to work on Saturdays, a sure sign of a Shabbat-celebrating Jew. His accusers also claimed that the church on his property was being used to store wheat, not for prayer, and they had discovered that Gomez's mother had been a convicted converso, a serious claim. A trial was launched, during which Gomez denied that he had ever practiced Jewish customs and had numerous friends write letters and present evidence that he was a good and honest Christian man. But despite his attempts at defense, he was convicted the following year, receiving a large fine and having his property seized. The list of conversos prosecuted by the Spanish Inquisition in the New World goes on. Diego de Ocaña, Juan Fernández de Castillo, Juan de Baeza, and others. As the Inquisition ramped up, tribunals were organized in the cities of Lima and Cartagena, and in 1574, the first auto-da-fé was held in the New World. These public trials, which often culminated in the burning of convicted conversos, would continue until at least 1659, leading to hundreds of deaths. While Spain and Portugal were starting to colonize the Americas and the Inquisition was spreading into the New World, Jews living in Eastern Europe were undergoing their own historical transformation. Last season, we discussed the origins of Ashkenazi Jewry in the early 9th century and the development of the community's early culture and structure in France and Germany. But by the beginning of the 10th century, Ashkenazi Jews had already begun to migrate east from Germany into the Kingdom of Poland. There, they formed small Jewish communities, or shtetls, and began to produce coins for the Polish government, some with Hebrew writing on them. The impetus for this eastward migration of Ashkenazi Jews included several different factors. First was the rising tide of anti-Semitism in Western Europe, which had started with the First Crusade and intensified with the rise of the blood libel and host desecration myths and to the mass expulsions of Jews from England and France in the 13th century. At the same time, the Polish economy was struggling following invasions by the Mongols, and so local Polish leaders had begun actively inviting Jews to immigrate to their kingdom. As we've discussed before, Jews were known to be literate, numerate, and business savvy, and so the Polish leadership was hopeful that Jewish immigration could help boost their economy. As an insurance policy, they also decided to charge Jews a special poll tax, which helped to fund the Polish army. In 1264, in an effort to encourage Jewish immigration, the Duke of Poland signed into law the Statute of Kalisz, which granted Jews in Poland protection against discrimination, the right to operate their own Jewish courts, and outlawed the spreading of the blood libel myth. A similar statute was adopted in Lithuania shortly thereafter. And so, the Ashkenazi populations of Poland and Lithuania steadily grew, developing their own unique culture. Whereas Jews in Ashkenaz were primarily moneylenders, the Jews who migrated to Poland tended to work more in crafts, trades, and land leasing. And just like in France and Germany, Polish Jews settled in Jewish shtetls and spoke Yiddish as their first language. They formed their own kehilot, one for each major Jewish community, and created two national Jewish organizations, which would serve to coordinate and negotiate directly with each kingdom's ruler on the Jews' behalf. These organizations were called the Council of the Four Lands in Poland and the Council of the Land of Lithuania in Lithuania, and would meet twice a year to make decisions for the Jews in the entire kingdom. Once a pronouncement was made by the council, however, it still had to be ratified by each individual community's kehillah before being put into practice. Overall, life for the Jews in 13th century Poland and Lithuania was pretty great, particularly compared to how Jews were being treated across the rest of Europe. And, as a result, there was a large wave of migration eastward over the course of the 14th century. But, in 1495, a new Grand Duke of Lithuania was crowned, Alexander Jagiellon, son of Casimir IV, and although no one is quite sure why, he abruptly expelled all Jews from Lithuania. Most of the Lithuanian Jews fled west to Poland, and a small number to the Crimean Peninsula. But 8 years later, when Alexander became King of Poland, he seemed to change his mind, no doubt because he was ostensibly broke and found himself at the whims of the Polish Senate. And so he once again allowed Jews to return to Lithuania, with all property that had been confiscated from them being returned. The timing was good for the Jews, because just then, Germany was persecuting and expelling its Jews following a German war with the Hussites, an early Protestant movement from Bohemia. So Poland once again became a haven for Jews, at least for the time being. By this point, we have taken a pretty good look at Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and the Americas in the early 16th century, but we have not yet explored the Middle East. The last we heard of this region was way back at the turn of the 13th century, just after Saladin and his Ayyubid dynasty had conquered the Kingdom of Jerusalem from the Crusaders. So, we're going to need to rewind slightly in order to catch ourselves up. By the mid-13th century, the majority of Palestine was in control of Saladin's Ayyubid dynasty, with the Christian Kingdom of Jerusalem having been whittled down to just a small sliver of land in the north of modern-day Israel, and along the coast of southern Lebanon. But a new Muslim dynasty was rising, who would go on to challenge Ayyubid supremacy in the region. This new power was originally founded by slaves who had been captured and converted by Muslim dynasties to enlist in their armies. Whole legions of these converted slaves, called Mamluks in Arabic, would be assembled, and over time they developed a reputation as fearsome warriors. The Mamluks initially numbered just a few thousand, but in the year 1250, a seventh crusade was making its way to Jerusalem to conquer Israel from the Muslims, led by King Louis IX of France. In preparation of the attack, the Ayyubids recruited thousands more Mamluks into their army. When they met in battle, the Mamluks ended up winning a decisive victory against the Crusaders and managed to capture King Louis himself. This put them in a position of great power, and they decided to make a bid for dominance, murdering the heir to the Ayyubid throne and instead installing one of their own Mamluk generals as Sultan in 1260. This officially marked the fall of the Ayyubid Caliphate and the beginning of the Mamluk Empire, which would secure its hold on Egypt and go on to conquer Palestine from the Mongols in 1260. By the year 1291, the Mamluks had managed to push all the Crusaders out of the Middle East as well, securing their foothold in the region. Palestine remained under Mamluk control for approximately 250 years, during which time Muslim culture and society flourished. The Mamluk capital was in Cairo, Egypt, but they had extending districts ruled by governors in Syria, Jordan, and Libya. What made the Mamluks unique was that most of them had not been born Muslim, having been enslaved and converted by the Ayyubid armies in the decades prior. And so, perhaps to justify their rule over subjects who had been faithful Muslims for generations, the Mamluks adopted quite a fundamentalist style of Muslim observance and law. They established numerous Islamic law colleges and convents, appointed various chief justices for each Sunni school of law, and held fairly strictly to the Pact of Umar, designating Christians and Jews in the empire as dhimmi, second-class citizens. Throughout the 14th and 15th centuries, however, the Mamluks faced some significant challenges. The Black Death was a major problem for them. In 1348 and 49, an outbreak wiped out a third of Egypt and Syria's population, and there were 12 more outbreaks over the course of the 15th century. This caused significant depopulation, loss of revenue from land taxes, hamstrung production of local goods, and caused a falloff in international trade. Not only that, but a series of Mongol invasions during the first 70 years of the Mamluk Sultanate and a second string of invasions in the beginning of the 15th century led to further economic strain. The Mamluks were wanting for money, and so they decided to employ similar tactics to the Christian kings, levying heavy taxes, particularly on dhimmis, confiscating property, and exploiting peasant labor. This heavy taxation and exploitation of Jews and Coptic Christians led to a significant exodus of Jews from the Middle East. Half of the Jewish communities in Egypt disappeared in the first century of Mamluk rule, and nearly 1,000 Jewish families from the city of Alexandria fled. Most of the Jews who remained in Mamluk territory moved to Cairo in Egypt. For the Jews who remained in the Mamluk Empire, the conditions of day-to-day living depended heavily on who was actually ruling at the time. In the first 75 years of Mamluk rule, for example, Jewish life was no cakewalk. The Mamluks were still trying to win over their newly conquered Muslim population, and anti-dhimmi sentiment was at an all-time high in the wake of the most recent crusade. All the rules of the Pact of Umar were reenacted, including prohibitions on Jews and Christians holding any jobs in government or fighting in the army, on dhimmi riding mules or horses, and an enforced dress code by which dhimmi had to wear specially colored turbans in order to mark their ethnicity. Jews wore yellow, Coptic Christians blue, and Samaritans red. As one Muslim historian describes, Jews in the early Mamluk Empire existed in a state of, quote, extreme humiliation and degradation, unquote. Although this sounds pretty dreadful, the reality was that many of these anti-dhimmi laws were more of a PR move than anything, and were loosely enforced, if at all. Most Jewish bureaucrats were able to keep their jobs, slave laws were never enforced, and dhimmi could still purchase land, even though it was technically illegal. Although waves of mob violence did occur from time to time, the Mamluk government did try to protect Jews from it, sheltering them behind city walls or within palaces and punishing the perpetrators. For those laws that were enforced, the Jews easily found loopholes. Because the Mamluk's justice system had various schools of Sunni law operating in parallel, Jews could shop around to different judges in order to find the ones most sympathetic to their legal cases. To get around some anti-dhimmi laws, many families would have one member convert to Islam, while the rest of the family remained Jewish. This allowed upward social mobility for the convert while allowing wealth to stay within the family, based on Jewish laws of inheritance. But by the mid-14th century, the Mamluks began to toughen up on the Jews. In 1354, a barrage of new anti-dhimmi laws were enacted, including a prohibition on dhimmi bathing with Muslims, laws restricting the size of dhimmi homes and turbans, laws preventing dhimmi from holding any government job, even if they converted to Islam, and a prohibition on dhimmi owning Muslim slaves. And, to prevent Jews using token Muslim converts to accumulate wealth or status, they introduced a law prohibiting dhimmi from operating under any of their own religious laws, meaning that inheritances could only be passed down according to Muslim law. This period, particularly after the introduction of the 1354 laws, saw a rise in anti-dhimmi sentiment, with several waves of mob violence and forced conversion occurring in Cairo and other major cities. Although Jews were clearly second-class citizens in Mamluk society, they were not as reviled as their counterparts in Christian Europe. They were never physically isolated to ghettos, they were free to participate in public and religious events, such as royal processions and coronations, they worshipped at the same sites as Muslims and Christians, and would take part in public demonstrations of prayer, such as prayers for rain or to end epidemics of the Black Death. There was actually a rich bi-directional flow of intellectual thought and spiritualism between Muslims and Jews. Some Jews were fascinated by Islamic mysticism, called Sufism, some feeling it was a restoration of forgotten ancient Jewish customs. And Muslim intellectuals would study Jewish philosophical and medical texts, particularly those of Maimonides. Just like in ancient Rome, Persia, Parthia, and the early Muslim Empire, Jews in Mamluk Palestine had a community leader and representative called the Nagid, who was responsible for organizing the community, ensuring compliance with the Pact of Umar, supervising the practice of religion, organizing social services for the Jewish community, and ensuring that Jews obeyed Mamluk law. The early Nagidim were the direct descendants of Maimonides, but by the second half of the 15th century, the position began to be fielded by physicians to the Sultan or other high-ranking Jews. By the late 14th century, the Turkish line of sultans had ended, and a new cultural line, the Circassians, took control of the Mamluk Empire. By this period, enough time had passed since the last crusade that the fierce anti-dhimmi sentiment that had been widespread had diminished, and many anti-dhimmi laws were relaxed or abolished. But Jews were still unfairly taxed compared to their Muslim counterparts, and for the first time, the medical field began to discriminate against Jews. A growing number of Muslim physicians refused to teach non-Muslim students, and dhimmi physicians were forbidden from treating Muslims. This was the first time in the Muslim world that medicine began to discriminate based on religious or ethnic background. By the beginning of the 16th century, Sephardim began to arrive in Egypt, fleeing the Spanish Inquisition, increasing the Jewish population and improving their economic situation. This wave of Sephardi migrants quickly began to fill roles as chief rabbis, dayanim or judges, and established important yeshivot. Within just a couple generations, the Mustaribs, or Arabic Jews, and Sephardim in Egypt melded completely into a single community. By the turn of the 16th century, the Mamluk Empire had begun to fade in power and importance, and it would not be long before they would be overrun by another Muslim empire, the Ottomans. I've mentioned the Ottoman Empire a few times already on the podcast, first at the very end of last season, and then several times sprinkled throughout the last episode. But it is now that they will come to play a massive part in the Jewish story, and so it's worth taking a closer look at who they were and how their overtaking of the Middle East affected Jewish life. Last season, we learned that the Ottomans were a group of Turks from the region of Anatolia, who were founded by Osman I, a former Seljuk commander. Osman's group slowly grew over time, attracting Muslim nomads and unemployed people leaving the bigger cities. Over the course of the 14th century, the Ottomans steadily expanded their territory, primarily by raiding and conquering Byzantine lands. In 1451, Mehmed II became Sultan, with a grand ambition to conquer the entire Christian world. And in 1453, he had his first major military success when he and his army conquered the Byzantine capital of Constantinople. With Constantinople well in hand, Mehmed II was finally equipped to fulfill his unique vision of what the Ottoman Empire would become, a multicultural empire in which people of all backgrounds could live happily and freely in self-governing communities while remaining loyal to their Ottoman overlords. But despite his progressive vision, the guy was still a 15th century Ottoman. So he decided to make his vision a reality by forcibly repopulating people from different Ottoman-controlled territories into Constantinople, threatening them with death should they not cooperate. This systematic forced relocation was called Surgun, and it had several benefits for the Ottomans. Besides promoting multiculturalism, it also helped to bring skilled workers into major city centers, increased the general labor force, and sometimes was used as a blackmail or hostage tool to keep various populations in line. One of the first Jewish communities to be forcibly resettled in Constantinople were the Romaniot. They were descendants of Byzantine Jews who had lived in the Balkans and had refused to support the Byzantine governor during the Ottoman siege of 1453, buying them some brownie points with the Ottomans. They spoke Yavanic, or Judeo-Greek, as their first language, had their own synagogues and Jewish courts, had their own unique cuisine, music, and fashion, and held to some of their own religious beliefs that differed from standard Ashkenazi ones. Much of our information about this community comes from a history of the Ottomans written by Constantinople's chief rabbi, Elia Kapsali. But a second wave of Jewish immigration would soon follow. In 1481, Sultan Mehmed II died and was succeeded by Bayezid II. Bayezid inherited Mehmed's multicultural mind and spent the early years of his rule trying to fix some of the social and economic problems his predecessor had caused. One way of doing this was to encourage Jews fleeing the Spanish Inquisition to immigrate to Constantinople, in part to boost the Ottoman economy. The result of this open-door policy for Spanish Jews was that, under Bayezid, tens of thousands of Sephardim immigrated from Spain in 1492. But the Sephardim and Romaniot did not always see eye to eye, owing to the significant cultural and religious differences between them. For a start, they spoke different languages. The Sephardim spoke Ladino, or Portuguese, while the Romaniot spoke Yavanic. The two groups also had developed fundamentally different social structures. The Sephardim had a complex social hierarchy, in which Jews were subdivided based on their city of origin, and further partitioned based on whether they were Jews or conversos. The Romaniot, on the other hand, were generally a more cohesive community. The two communities also had different ways of viewing their own histories. Because they had lived in Byzantine lands for centuries, the Romaniot felt firmly rooted to the land, whereas the Sephardim saw themselves as being part of a cycle of exiles, which they called Gerush. Finally, as was true in most places where Ashkenazim and Sephardim mixed, the Romaniot felt that the Sephardim had an air of superiority about them, which rubbed the Romaniot the wrong way. This was made particularly salient by the fact that Sephardim did have some very real advantages in Ottoman society. Because they had come to Constantinople of their own free will, as opposed to having been forced there under the Surgun, they were generally treated better than the Romaniot by the Ottomans. All of these differences quickly caused significant tension between the two communities. Adding to the pressure was the fact that Sultan Bayezid was less tolerant of the Jews than Mehmed had been, and reinstated a ban on the construction of synagogues, forced Jews to wear identifying clothing when in public, and enacted a number of other repressive anti-Semitic laws. In 1512, Bayezid was replaced by Sultan Selim I, a bit of a nut job who was much more conquest-oriented than his predecessors. Under Selim, the Ottoman Empire engaged in a push east, and by 1515, they had conquered the Anatolian Peninsula, putting their southern border right up against the Mamluks' eastern edge. Just 1 year later, in 1516, the Ottomans overthrew the Mamluks at the Battle of Marj Dabiq, assuming control of the entire Mamluk Empire, including Palestine and Egypt. In the wake of this war, two large pogroms, or anti-Jewish attacks, took place in the cities of Hebron and Sfat, in which Jews were slaughtered and raped. Jewish homes and businesses were looted and destroyed, and many of the surviving Jews fled the cities. To add insult to injury, the Nagadate, which had been an official channel for Jews to advocate for themselves to the formerly Mamluk government, was abolished. In the year 1520, Suleiman I, also known as Suleiman the Magnificent, became the next Ottoman Sultan, and brought the empire to its full glory. He rebuilt Jerusalem's walls, tiled the Dome of the Rock in gold, a project that was incidentally funded by two Jews, and oversaw a second wave of Sephardic Jewish immigration to Constantinople. By the time Suleiman came to power, the Ottoman Empire was one of the largest in the world, extending from modern-day Bosnia and Romania down the Adriatic coast, sweeping east all the way into modern-day Ukraine, encompassing Greece, Turkey, Syria, Palestine, the Maghreb, and nearly the entire northern coast of Africa. And that catches us back up to the 1530s, the same time in which we had left off the other strands of our story. The Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions had just made their way to the New World, where Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors were establishing colonies and clashing with the Aztecs and Incas. Ashkenazi Jews were continuing to move east into Russia, Poland, and Lithuania, and David Haraouveni and Shlomo Molcho had just been arrested for attempting to convert the Holy Roman Emperor to Judaism. By 1535, the Jewish population of Constantinople was between 40 and 50,000 people, the vast majority being Sephardim and a small minority Romaniot. This compared to the meager 1,600 Jews living in Jerusalem at the same time. Most of Constantinople's Jews lived in crowded districts on either side of the Golden Horn, the small river running right through the center of the city. Most of these Jews were lower middle class and lived in small wooden one- or two-room homes. If they were lucky, they could afford to live in multi-story stone tenement buildings by the river. The few wealthy Jews lived in an upscale district called Galata, which was mostly occupied by Christian European merchants. Jews in Constantinople at that time had a variety of jobs. The poorest would go door-to-door selling soaps, knives, or buttons. Up one rung on the social ladder were the merchants and retailers, who would sell their wares in markets or along city streets. The wealthier Jews worked as bankers, printers, weapons makers, tailors, fishermen, goldsmiths, jewelers, cloth merchants, cheese and spice merchants, or as sheep and cattle drovers. And of course, as had been long-standing tradition in many Muslim polities, there were Jewish physicians. The Ottoman sultans in particular had a tradition of having personal Jewish physicians, as they worried that Muslims might be in cahoots with the political rival of the sultan, whereas a Christian physician might wish to seek vengeance after the Ottoman takeover of Constantinople. So Jews were felt to be the safest option. The first Jewish physician to an Ottoman sultan was Jacopo of Gaeta, physician to Murad II and Mehmed II, who ended up converting to Islam and changing his name to Hekim Hekub Pasha. He was succeeded by Yosef Hamon, a Spanish Jew who arrived in Constantinople in 1493, fleeing the expulsion. Yosef became personal physician to Sultan Bayezid II and ended up staying on as physician to the two subsequent sultans, Selim I and Suleiman the Magnificent. Yosef was hugely influential to Jews in Constantinople. During his time in the palace, the ban on Jews riding horses was waived for Jewish physicians, and he formed a special guild for the 41 Jewish royal physicians, making up two-thirds of the total royal entourage of doctors. Yosef also became an unofficial representative of the Sephardic community of Constantinople, advocating to the Sultan on their behalf. In his old age, Yosef passed the torch to his son, Moses Hamon, who in his own right became a very significant Jewish figure. Not only was he a physician, but, in the tradition of Maimonides, He was also a rabbinical scholar, owned one of the greatest libraries in the Levant, published numerous works in Hebrew and Ladino, and built his own school of Jewish learning in Constantinople. Like his father before him, Moses advocated to the Sultan on behalf of the Jews of the Ottoman Empire, particularly attempting to shut down extortion of Jews by local officials and blood libel accusations that would spring up from time to time. But Moses Hamon also played a small but pivotal role in the daring escape from Portugal of the wealthiest Jew in the world, a story that we will hear next week on The Jewish Story. And that's where we'll end this episode. Next week, we will meet one of the most prominent Jewish families in the 16th century world and watch them transform Jewish life forever.